This is the Education Gadfly Show.
I'm surprised you have time. I imagine you're busy trying to fend off requests to serve as Secretary of Education.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at fordhaminstitute.org. And now, please join me in welcoming our special guest for this week, Paul Hill. Paul, welcome to the show.
Hello, Mike. Glad to be on.
Great to have you on. Paul, for those that don't know, is the founder of the Center on Reinventing Public Education and research professor at the University of Washington, Bothell. Also hails from Ohio, a place very near and dear to our heart here at Fordham. It's great to have you with us. Also joining us, as always, David Griffith.
Hey, Mike. Good to be here.
Yes, indeed. David's from the Great Northwest as well, Paul.
From Portland, I think.
Yes, Paul, so excited to have you on the show. I'm surprised you have time. I imagine you're busy trying to fend off requests to serve as Secretary of Education in the Biden administration.
Yeah, well, actually, it was going to, either way, it would be that way. And I just have my pizza taking care of all those calls.
That's good.
Sorry, Joe, no time to talk.
All right, good. Well, hey, we do have a lot to talk about, though, because you have been really writing and thinking a lot about what this whole COVID crisis means for our schools. You had a great piece recently in the Brookings Chalkboard, and we want to talk about that. Let's do that in Ed Reform Update. All right, Paul. So you asked the question in this piece, can public education return to normal after the COVID-19 pandemic? So what's the answer?
Well, I think it can't. It's sort of obvious that almost anybody would prefer that we could put it all back as it was and kids could be in school all the time and parents could count on the times when they were able to work freely and teachers could work the old way. We might have thought that those arrangements weren't working so well, but they certainly fit the way the world worked. And that was kind of independent of the school reform battles that we're familiar with, like charter schools, for the most part. So Ashley Yockum and I, have taken a very expressly political way of thinking about this, is who's supporting what, who has a reason to support what, and what old constituencies may be coming apart. And as we thought about it, I started thinking about the unions, which have this, I think, a very interesting position right now, which is they're defending their teachers against physical risk and, you know, wanting to protect teachers as much as possible. But at the same time, two things. One, a lot of teachers would rather, all things being equal, be in the classroom. And secondly, the longer this arrangement with teachers not in the classroom goes on, the more the whole idea that's baked into collective bargaining agreements that a teacher has a classroom and that they're either responsible for the whole day's instruction or for a part of the day's instruction on shifting a bunch of kids on the same topic over and over again, but that basically there's a teacher and there are kids and they're nested inside schools and you can regulate the terms and conditions of teacher employment based on those assumptions. So you can regulate numbers of minutes of student contact and maximum minimum class sizes and how much free time teachers get and even sort of say, well, they're all commodities, and so you can ignore rarity of skills or performance metrics and just pay on some teachers are working now has no real resemblance to the assumptions baked into collective bargaining agreements. Some of them are teaching real time and others are not. Some teachers are actually taking responsibility for instruction of a group or of a topic, full responsibility, and others are not. Some people are doing only an enrichment and catch up, and in a sense, the differentiation of teacher roles right now is everyone from kind of an online version of the old one to people that practically don't have responsibility for students or maybe doing essentially tutoring. And it continues very long. I think the unions are going to be under pressure to try to put the old system back. And so at some point they may flip-flop and go from don't open the schools to by God, open the schools. And when that happens, that might create a tension internally where right now they're going with the most at-risk teachers and probably the most senior ones and satisfying them. And that may force the unions to jettison some people or to put up with some internal divisions. And you look at parents, you know, the internal divisions of parents, not just on preference and party, but on their perceived risk for their children and, you know, their grandparents who might live in the house and the like. And then the problems of parents, the level of mutual trust that used to apply. When you take your child to school, you assume that people are not sending a child to school that's going to give them a lethal illness. But, you know, now with the uncertainty about vaccinations and not only that COVID, but even the vaccinations for measles and so on, a lot of parents are going to be reluctant to come back to school, even when that's the option that almost everybody else wants. So that would just be just illustrations of how constituencies that used to be kind of pliable and able to deal with on a unitary basis are going to be much more chaotic.
I certainly get that now and for, let's say, the rest of the school year. Although, you know, we just got great news that the Pfizer vaccine shows great effectiveness. You know, that's going to take a while for that to roll out. But you can imagine that, you know, relatively maybe early in 2021, we could get educators all vaccinated if they're made to be a priority. I mean, certainly it seems like by next fall, couldn't we just kind of have everybody back to normal, everybody back in schools? And what's going to keep the system from just snapping back in place?
That's a fair question, and you can lay out a scenario where that's possible. I doubt it. I'm less dubious, less skeptical about the possibility of an effective COVID vaccine than I am of, in this case, the consequences of kids not getting their measles vaccines and not getting flu vaccines. And, and I think there's going to be continuing anxiety about people gathering together in groups, even if the COVID situation is in better shape. The numbers of people concerned about that may be down, but I think still there'll be teachers who are afraid to go full-time to school and parents that don't want their children to do it, not to mention teachers that found very satisfying ways to practice without going to school, and parents, which may be a minority, but think that they're, on balance, their kids are doing better with the arrangements they've made. It's possible that public education could just decide that it's going to go back to the old way and suffer some attrition. You know, have people decide that they're going to go to homeschooling or something else. Same with teachers. But I think it's more likely that public education will try to accommodate those differences, that it will become a much wider range of instructional media and instructional designs will be common. A good number of kids will not just be going to one school, and a good number of teachers may not be just teaching in one school. If those, for example, specialist teachers who've turned out to be really good online or whose skills, essay math teachers or physics teachers, can be used much more broadly than in one school, you know, they can see why they would want to do that. So I don't think the normal practice is going to settle down very quickly, and I don't think the politics are either. So that is essentially what we were arguing. Now, how far out can you push it? I can be convinced that if it's not 2021-22, it's 2022-23 when COVID is gone. But by then, I think there would be so many different variations in practice and preferences that it would be hard to put the system back anyway.
Well, that's interesting. And, you know, it sounds different than some of the enthusiasm we've heard about how, oh, these pandemic pods are going to be here forever. We're going to have so many parents go to homeschool. I mean, some of our friends on the more libertarian side are very excited about all of that. I've been dubious that maybe it's just as a parent, I'm speaking personally, I'm like looking forward to going back to just being a parent and not also being the co-teacher. Although, look, there's been some wonderful and very sweet parts about having my kids around all the time and being around them, to be clear, in case they're listening. But, you know, I'm just skeptical, right? That most parents will. But you're talking about something different.
I am to a degree, but I also think that pods are an element of instructional environment and practice that a lot of people want to continue. If they become something for only the elite and they become divisive, then the public schools might not support them. But if they turn out to be real assets for certain parents in low-income communities, you know, if they become a solution for parents who otherwise are having hell of a time getting to work, maybe I'm making too much of this, but I really do think that it's going to take a good long time before parents fully trust one another in the ways they just automatically did in the past.
Yeah.
If that's the way you know that there are only 10 other families involved in this pod, and we know who they are.
Yeah.
I think that has an advantage. And whether, you know, whether pods turn out to be de facto tiny schools or whether they turn out to be, you know, every school is an aggregate of 10 pods, or, you know, I still think there's a possibility that that helps solve some of the trust problems. So I wouldn't discount it, but I do think that a lot of people are going to want to go back to school. And I think that cuts across. I think that people that were paying a great deal of money, you know, $40,000 a year to send their kids extremely fine schools, are going to want to have all that back, just as everybody else does.
Paul, is there any data out there? Is it all anecdotal or impressionistic that this is the sort of thing that's happening?
Yeah, I don't think there's a good database you can go to for it. It's anecdotal in the degree that a lot of people in a lot of places under different circumstances are telling you the same story.
Right. So you're saying the plural of anecdote.
Yeah, if its plurality is quite large and representative, it's more than that. CERPI did the case studies of districts, and that all stopped in mid-September, so we don't have an update on that yet. But there it was tremendously clear that the superintendents were aware of vast differences in what teachers were doing.
What are we talking about here? Are there particular practices that you're hearing about a lot? You mentioned tutoring.
Again, I want to be a little cautious because what we hear from people may be aspirational. But what we heard from superintendents, for example, some of them were able to snoop in on Zoom classes. And suddenly you had a degree of visibility of top administrators into actual teaching that they couldn't get. they were very convinced that there were some teachers that were absolute wizards at material presentation and others that were anything but. That started to suggest to them role differentiation, where you got as many kids access to the wizardly presenters and then built a, you know, kind of an enrichment and support role for other people. Now, that might not come about the way that people were talking about it. Now, I think it's going to take a big national survey to get the answer, and I'm hoping maybe, you know, RAND has that national panel of teachers and principals. I think that's going to provide the best evidence we can get in the short run. I wouldn't venture to say that I have the exact numbers on any of this stuff, and my argument was more that you can see how the interests are diverging and why people would want to do this, these different approaches. Now, what you raised to me, obviously the funding question, you know, how do you fund these different mechanisms? And I've always had a straightforward answer to that is you fund kids and you might have some regulations and limitations on how parents can use the money. But on the other hand, you also want them to be able to adapt what the kids get. But then on accountability, it's obvious that the more varied publicly funded practice is, the more difficult it is to do it on based on all one test and things like that. And we'll probably need a lot more reliance on authentic outcome measures, you know, like in the class measures and also a lot more attention to reveal preference data. What kind of teaching environment do people really want to get into and what are they trying to get out of and so on?
And who wants to not have to have a commute to their school anymore? We are going to have to leave it there, Paul.
Do you have a minute for an anecdote?
Yeah, please.
So I was running the RAND office in Washington when Reagan took office. And at Christmas time, the office closed down for a long time. And I came in just to see what was going on. And I saw a pink message slip that a very low-level telephone operator had taken. It was for a very important RAND foreign policy guy from Alexander Haig. It had been sitting there for 2 weeks. That's not happening to me.
That's said. All right, well, you never know, Paul. You never know. All right, Paul Hill, again, founder of the Center on Reinventing Public Education. Thanks so much for joining us, Paul.
Thank you.
Now it's time for everyone's favorite. It's Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Just had a great chat with Paul Hill, just one of those people that has been so thoughtful for so long on all of our issues.
Yes.
I tell you,
Paul.
It's exciting. You know, I have to say, I remember being a young pup in this field and so excited when I first got to talk to somebody like a Paul Hill. And I still find it exciting to get to talk.
I mean, he and Checker, right, are just the titans in ed reform.
They are some of the giants in the field. And interesting perspective here. I feel a little more convinced that maybe this pandemic's going to lead to some lasting changes after all. All right. So what you got for us this week, Amber?
We have a new study that looks at the impacts of after-school programs on early high school outcomes, which I'll talk about what that means in a second. I feel like there's a lot of interest in how to serve the needs of disadvantaged kids outside of the school day. I know this is something you're interested in as well, Mike, in terms of how to extracurriculars and all those things work together to enhance benefits for kids. What's cool about this is one of the first studies that actually uses oversubscribed admissions lotteries. So we've got a great, you know, study design here to examine the impacts on lottery winners and losers of a multi-year after-school program. So I'd not heard of this, but it's called Student U. It's a comprehensive program that provides education, nutrition, extracurricular, and social support services to needy kids in Durham, North Carolina. It's pretty intense. I mean, when I actually read about the program, it starts in the summer before sixth grade. It goes for 7 years through their high school year of high school. Rising sixth graders attend a 6-week, 8 to 4 o'clock everyday program in the summer. That's kind of what kicks them off. And it strengthens their academic skills through small groups taught by local college students, which is nice. And they also have a component where kids get to kind of pursue their personal interests. They choose electives like arts and poetry and astronomy or whatever. And then during the school year, they participate in 15 hours per week of after-school programming for 30 weeks during the school year. They get tutoring. They get extracurricular activities, sports, the arts. And then basically, it's just this really rich, comprehensive program. Families and students sign contracts to participate in the program over these 7 years, and all of the services are completely free. Because of the nature of the program, there's only 50 kids in each cohort. So, eligibility. Students parents must not have attended college. So basically, the child has to be the first person in their immediate family to attend college and or eligible for free and reduced lunch. StudentU started using admissions lotteries in spring of 2012. So analysts are looking at three lottery-based cohorts in 2012 through 2014. All right, results indicate that the lottery winners accumulated 0.45 more course credits than lottery losers by the end of ninth grade. But what was interesting, when they interact lottery status with baseline achievement of how kids were performing in fifth grade, they find that the effects are almost entirely driven by the students with low baseline achievement in fifth grade. And that pattern repeats itself over multiple outcomes that they look at. So such that lottery winners who entered the program with low baseline achievement earned more course credits, about 0.82 course credits, achieved higher GPAs, about 0.37 grade points, and were less likely to be suspended, 17.1 percentage points, during ninth grade than their lottery loser counterparts. They also do a back of the envelope estimate, and because they don't have all the high school graduation data, so they kind of have to estimate that, they think the lottery winners are around 4 percentage points more likely to graduate from high school than lottery losers. And then they just kind of really drive the point home, and they say that by the end of ninth grade, students who entered the program with average fifth grade test scores that were nearly one standard deviation below the statewide mean more closely resembled and in some cases had better outcomes than their counterparts who entered the program with high baseline achievement. So they were able to sort of close that gap when they looked at the lottery winners by achievement level. Now we talk a little bit about cost. They did some ROI. They found that the program cost about $16,000 per student for 4 years of programming, which they say is actually in line with similar after-school programs. They give us some other names and numbers of other programs that provide similar services. So they close by saying, you know, these are comprehensive after-school programs. Obviously, there's a lot involved here, but it looks like in this case, they're more effective for improving outcomes for students with low levels of achievement the most. So that's what I've got.
Wow. Really exciting, Amber.
Yeah.
Intensive. I mean, this is not a cheap program. This sounds like a lot more than what you might see in the typical, say, 21st Century Learning Centers program that the Fed's funded for a long time, you know, which was a little bit, my sense is spread the money around more so than this one did. Right.
Yeah. 50 kids a cohort. Like that's, you know, that's a small cohort. Yeah.
And, you know, even though the effects were biggest for the sort of lowest performing kids, I'm not sure that you'd want to just limit it to the lowest performing kids necessarily. Right. In part because maybe it would be less effective if they were only around other really low performing kids. Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Could be.
Yeah. So that's interesting. And of course, it strikes me that this is kind of like what many of the high performing charter schools do, or they include that as part of their regular program, is to have kids at school longer and getting a lot of these kinds of services. David, what do you think?
I mean, okay, before I jump to ROI, right? I think it is comforting to know that you can move the needle, because I mean, to be totally honest, right? Like there are times when, you know, if you look at the research, you can question whether anything can reach some of the toughest kids, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the answer is yes, or at least based on this and some other studies, like, yes, it can. It's got to be a lot, though.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to do my back of the envelope math here, right? You're saying it was 7 years, but then it was 16,000 for 4 years.
For 4 years. That was right. That's how they estimated it. Yeah.
Okay. So presumably it's 28,000 for 7 years, or am I misunderstanding?
Yeah, I'm not so sure why we didn't get 7 years. That was a little odd to me too.
That's basically another year of school. At that point, you're talking about the amount of money. I mean, Mike, you should like this, right? I mean, it's another year of school, but you're sort of force feeding it to the kids during school. I guess one takeaway for me is I think we should be paying more attention to just interventions that do increase the amount of time. Right? Because you run into this issue, you know, if you try to add another year of school, which is, I think, something that we're going to continue to discuss in the wake of the coronavirus, you know, you run into kids dropping out and that sort of thing. And I think it might be more effective to up the intensity is, I guess, where I'm going with this. And that sort of is how I take this to be.
I also say, you know, we've talked a lot about discipline, suspensions on the show. I like this using the suspensions as a measure of how effective the program was, because they didn't have any, you know, I think there was no control over the decisions. It wasn't like they were controlling what happens during the school day and whether kids get, it just meant that something happened that helped these kids behave better, one would think, which is the whole, we should all embrace that, whatever side we are on this suspensions and discipline debate, that this is, we would all like to reduce the number of children who misbehave and as a result, the number of children who end up getting suspended. So this is great. We should kind of, that's something we come around together on.
Amber, did they say anything? I mean, did they speculate about mechanisms or which elements of the program were more important?
They came up with something that was student effort. I'm trying to remember how they operationalized that. But yeah, they did do some kind of mechanism stuff, but it didn't strike me as particularly impressive. So I think that's why I didn't include too much of it in my write-up.
All right. Well, we will leave it there, folks. Thank you, Amber. It's nice to get something uplifting right now, given, you know, 2020 hasn't always delivered on that front. So thank you for that. Just a reminder again to our listeners, please do go check out our podcast on the Apple Podcasts app and give us a rating and a review if you don't mind. That's going to help other folks find us. And of course, let your friends and family know about this podcast too. We've been doing this, can you believe it, for almost a decade and a half? We are like the granddaddy of education policy podcasts, but there's still people in our world who don't know about it. So share the word. All right. Enough for my infomercial. Until next week.
I'm David Griffith.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at fordhaminstitute.org.